This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
So our next panel is really a continuation of some of the discussion that started earlier. It's on a topic that seems like it's, in the last few years, been catapulted from the depths of obscurity to front page headline news on a regular basis, and that is public sector pensions. This is a conference about fiscal stress in California, and there's no denying that a major source of stress for state and local governments, many would say the major source, is the retirement benefits that governments have promised to their employees and failed to fund adequately. Certainly, the recession has no doubt contributed to the problem, but the pension troubles that state and local governments are facing right now didn't start in 2008. For many decades, for years and decades, public pension benefits have increased. Government employers in many places are pick up in some of the employees' contributions to those plans. And clearly, governments haven't made sufficient contributions to those plans to keep them funded. We don't even really fully agree on how these liabilities should be reported. So as Governor Brown has put it recently, the chickens have come home to roost. So we have five terrific panelists today to help us understand the pension mess, explain what California's recently signed pension legislation does, and also evaluate those reforms. Do they go far enough? Do they go too far? What should be done in the future? My name's Sarah Anzia. I'm an assistant professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy here at UC Berkeley. We have Stuart Drown, executive director of the Little Hoover Commission, Eric Hoffman, who's senior vice president of the Public Finance Group at Moody's Investor Service, Marty Morgenstern, secretary of the California Labor and Workforce Development Agency, Joe Nation, professor of the practice of public policy at Stanford University, and Bob Brownstein, research and policy director at Working Partnerships USA. So we will start with Stuart Drown.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you very much. I'm thrilled to be here. So Max and Jack, thank you, and Professor Anzia, welcome to Berkeley. In 2011, the Little Hoover Commission produced a set of recommendations for the governor and for the legislature on public policy, on public pension reforms. The goal was to establish guidelines for a sustainable system that could provide adequate pensions for current and future public employees. It was looking for a sustainable government system as well. So a sustainable system would be one that allowed cities, counties, and the state government to manage their pension plan expenses in a way that did not displace other government spending on promised services and programs. Now, we've heard a lot today about municipal bonds and bankruptcy. That is not where the commission entered into this. When it's talking about sustainability, they are talking about the government's role with the taxpayer and the voters' support of delivering a promised set of goods and services. So that's where they were. Now, the recommendations provided, they came in February of 2011, and I think some of you were here for that. It provided something of a jolt for the discussion on pension reform in Sacramento. We had the Wisconsin union things going on. We had six of the largest labor contracts out, and for once we had serious budget talks going on. It's the first time since I'd been in government that they're actually working towards a budget that was going to be signed in the summer as opposed to September or October. So 18 months later, many of these recommendations became part of the legislation that Governor Brown signed earlier this month, and that represent the biggest statewide pension reform in California in generation and build on work that was done by Governor Schwarzenegger's administration before. And yet, Governor Brown has said that this package is a first step, and even more needs to be done. We have to agree with that, but with this caveat, to offer this context, it was absolutely the outermost that could be accomplished through the legislative process. That's my take after watching it from the sidelines. But I encourage everybody here to think in terms of a broader policy arena where the situation is very much in flux. And we've heard a lot about that. That's the courts, that's bankruptcy courts, and that's most particularly at the bargaining table. And now we're hearing the talk of an initiative again. I'd also like to offer this context. Given the complexity of the subject and the difficulty of the politics, pension reform is moving at light speed. We work in a broad range of policy areas, and from where we are 3 years ago, this is astounding. This is its policy window. And so what is the problem? Well, quite simply, it's the only thing that's simple about this, is that state and local governments have not put aside enough money to cover future promised obligations as the plans are currently structured. And without change, taxpayers will be stuck with either fewer services for what they already pay or higher taxes to pay for, in this case, other people's benefits, a level of benefits that few expect for themselves. Certainly the stock market crash played a significant role in this, but overly optimistic assumptions about the forever upward climb of equities also made it possible for the market to do this much damage. You can add into that some weak management practices, some pension holidays, paying for the employee share, and you started to build distance between reality and the math. In California, we made things a lot worse by overpromising and then not putting aside the money to pay for our generosity. Senate Bill 400 in 1999 started a trend that is squeezing cities and counties and the state today. At the local level in particular, I was asked to repeat the salient phrase from our report, that these pension problems will crush government, and particularly local government. We got a lot of flack in Sacramento for that remark. And it's because of the state capitol there saying, we're not hearing from local governments that there's a problem. Surely they would have told us. This is 2010. I mean, you know, we were hearing those problems. Where's Mayor Reed? Mayor Reed testified at our hearing, and we talked to a lot of local governments. There was a lot of pain at that time. There's a lot more pain now. At the local level, it became the fastest growing parts of their budgets. It was crowding out other government services, closing senior centers, no summer jobs programs, less park maintenance, you know the rest, layoffs. At the state level, pension obligations as a portion of the general fund are growing, even though we were promised in SB 400 that they wouldn't. So now they're up to about $4 billion. Next year, if we add in what we need to do to bring the teachers up, that's another $4 billion. That's $8 billion. That's a lot of money. How big is the problem? This is something we examined as part of our study, but as I'll explain later, we didn't engage, and mainly for the reasons that I hope the rest of the panel will discuss. Estimates vary, and by orders of magnitude. The estimates of the assets are very heavily influenced by the point-in-time snapshots of the equity markets, which have seen extraordinary volatility. Since the crash, for example, CalPERS has seen 2 years of back-to-back double-digit returns. Well, that sounds fabulous. Except last year, they posted a 1% return. And had it not been for a 200-point rally on the final day of the quarter, they would have had a negative return. And then, next 3 months, they're looking great. Their equities are up. Estimated rates of return and estimates of future unfunded liabilities also vary and carry with them their own assumptions. And all of these pieces are worth detailed and kind of mature and quiet and reflective discussions. And this is an area of complexity I'll leave to my fellow panelists. The Pew Center on the States in its most recent estimates released this summer put the 2010, so we're looking backwards, the 2010 public employee unfunded liabilities at $757 billion for state government pension plans. And in the California estimate, that included CalSTRS, CalPERS, and the UC plan. And that was against a total obligation of $3 trillion for 2010 for nationwide for state plans. In 2010, Pew estimated California's overall pension liability at $516 billion and its unfunded liability at $112 billion. And at that point, and these are conservative estimates, they said that California's plans were 78% funded and that level rated serious or warranted serious concern. So there's yet another area of debate, which is what is safe? Is 80% safe? Is 70% safe? And I hope that we'll hear some discussion about that as well today. Critics of these plans' assumptions say that these estimates are far too optimistic. And we have people, Joe and Eric, I think, will be able to talk about this. The simple math dictates, though, that the rates that are used to assess both the assets and the present value of future unfunded liabilities, when you lower those, right now CalPERS is using 7.5%. They just lowered it from 7.75%. When you lower those, it obviously has the tendency to bump up the level of both total liabilities and unfunded liabilities. So this becomes very political very quickly. And so in CalPERS' case, when they lowered their discount rate to 7.5, it bumped up the how many other city finance directors do we have? It bumped up the amount that CalPERS will send the bill for. Then that bill will go out in 2 years. So they've agreed politically, because that's such harsh medicine, that they're going to spread that out to soften the pain. Two researchers, though, Joshua Rao and Robert Novy-Marks, started a new discussion and made the argument that since public employee benefits were a guarantee, then they should be looked at as a risk-free obligation. And so then they should use a risk-free rate of return, or a discount rate, rather, in judging the size of the future unfunded liabilities. And they use a blended treasury rate as well. Now, using this method, California's unfunded liabilities jumped up to $500 billion. That's a really big number. An analysis by a group of Stanford graduate students took a similar approach, and they saw that the state's three largest pension plans' unfunded liabilities bumped up from $55 billion to $500 billion. So these analyses sparked further debate and got other players to take up the issue, and we've got a series of new analyses that have refined these questions and offer a more nuanced discussion of what are realistic future returns on investments and how they should best be calculated. Now, if you read the commission's study, it's 18 months old, but I think it's still very relevant, especially going into this next, and it's free. I'm not going to sell it. It's free. You can download it. We didn't engage in this part of the debate. We saw that the discussion was so hot over this that we felt that when we did our analysis, we took the 10 largest pension plans in California and used the most recent numbers they had and the estimates that they used and the discount rates that they used, came up with $240 billion in unfunded liabilities. That was big enough for us to be worried. And so the question was, well, so it's $500 billion. It's, you know, it's a big problem. And it's a big problem at 240, and it's a big problem at 500. More worrisome was what we saw on the ground. Our commissioners, nine of them are private citizens. It's a citizen-led commission. They're very engaged with their communities. Most of them have done business or have been local politicians, and or as well as state elected officials, and what they saw was that these pension obligations became the fastest growing parts of the budgets, and they're eating up a share of shrinking revenues, an ever larger share of shrinking revenues. More people were retiring, they were retiring younger, they were living longer, and costs were rising sharply because of lower than expected returns and because of this underfunding. So at the state level, where personnel costs make up a relatively small portion of the general fund, at the local level, they can make up as much as 70% or sometimes more of the budget. So when revenue's down and pension costs become the fastest growing part of the budget, cities and counties were forced to make very tough choices. And this was the sustainability question that we were looking at. Now, so the reaction that we got publicly divided, became a very us and them with some public employee unions. But the commission felt that they go up to their traditional 30,000 feet. They're looking not only at current employees and wanted to make sure that current employees would have pensions in the future, defined benefit, plus we were recommending a hybrid plan, but that the state and locals would be able to attract quality future employees. So it was important not to take everything out of the future new hires. I mean, the state's going to have a difficult enough problem attracting talent. And then we are also looking at taxpayers, given what they'd agreed to pay, and at what was happening to consumers of government services, whether time is up. Okay, we're done.
So I'm one of the prior panelists referred to as the green eye shade guys, bond analyst at Moody's. So how do we get this? There we go. So I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about what Moody's is thinking about in terms of local government, state pension liabilities. Just going to tell you a few things about why we're thinking the way we are right now and what this might mean from our perspective for state and local government ratings. So just to start off, back on July 2nd, Moody's asked for, or we put out a request for comment on proposed adjustments to the pension accounting. You've heard Stuart talk about some of these numbers being very subject to the assumptions that you're making in evaluating them. And we are proposing to make some standardizing assumptions and making it easier for us to make comparisons. Right now, there's a great latitude in what's allowed in terms of assumptions and what is implemented, and we are trying to improve, at least from our analytical perspective, the comparability of these numbers. And so we're asking for and proposing these adjustments, and you have until the end of the month. We extended it a little while if you'd like to comment. Request for comment is on our website. It's available publicly. You just have to register when you come in, but it is in a public area of the website. Having said that, it's free. I feel like I should pitch Mark's book at this point. Website right there if you want to make comments, submit them. We've gotten lots of comments, as you can imagine. This is a very hot political issue right now. Lots of folks are interested in it. And it's just... to comment, we often put out requests for comments on our methodological change. It's a little unusual to put out a request for comment for what is effectively just a calculation change. Ultimately, it is just one element of our evaluation of a state or local government, but we sort of recognize that this is a big issue, and we want to make sure that all of the folks that might have an opinion on this, we hear them, and we're going in the right direction in the way we are thinking about this. So what is it we're proposing? We're proposing four things, and let me just get them all up there so you can see them. I didn't realize this was so nicely animated. First up, and this is a lot of fairly sort of wonky actuarial talk, so I'll go through it quickly. I know that most people probably don't want to pay that most close attention to what's a multi-employer plan versus single employer. But basically, you've heard mention of CalPERS, CalSTRS. There are multiple local governments that participate in those plans, and we are proposing, not very controversially, to allocate their unfunded liabilities amongst all of their participants. Nothing too interesting there, really. We are proposing, and this is sort of a lightning rod, I think, to recalculate the actuarial accrued liability using a much lower discount rate than a lot of folks are using. We're proposing a 5.5% rate based on what was a high-grade corporate bond index in these past 2 years. We're also proposing that investment returns are no longer going to be smooth. Right now, actuarial accounting and science and plan management doesn't recognize all those jumps in 1 year's market returns on the assets, say in the 1 year it occurred. They spread them out over multiple years. And we're proposing, let's just use, to make everybody comparable, we'll use the market value of your assets and take out this smoothing element, because you are, many of these plans, using different smoothing. You can use 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. And so it makes it hard to compare one government with the next. And then finally, we are basically going to amortize that unfunded liability over a consistent period. Right now, different plans use different periods, and you can use 30 years, 15 years, 20 years. And so it puts the numbers that we're looking at and the numbers in that chart that you saw with the various states earlier with the pension liability stacked on top of the debt liability, those numbers, while they're all in one chart, they're all based on a lot of different assumptions. They could be all very much different if you used consistent assumptions across the board. All that having been said, I'm bound to say what it says down here in the bold. This is a Moody's approved slide. That, you know, we're not proposing to create a new and different perfect actuarial measure for all of these local governments and make them perfectly comparable. We're focusing on what are the key assumptions that really drive these numbers significantly, and it's to enhance our analytical view of these numbers. So I've already touched on a little bit of this, go through this quickly. Really, again, these proposals are, from our perspective, to enhance consistency and comparability across governments. There is an element of conservatism that is in this. We would like to be conservative in our evaluation of risk, though true to the real risks out there. But there is a genuine view that I think that we've heard, and we've heard it from a lot of folks, you've heard mention of it already, that the assumptions that are being made right now in the current environment are overly optimistic. And if that's the case, we don't want to be overly optimistic. Let's dial it back a little bit. And ultimately, our objective here is to weigh the risk that these pension liabilities and these payments that are growing over time pose to debt service on bonds. And that's our only focus, really. And we aren't an advocacy organization. We really are just an evaluation organization, and we try to inform the market of the risks that they're taking. And to make all of this comparable and reasonably conservative, we think is a good idea. That having been said, these are just proposals at the moment, and again, anybody's welcome to disagree with us. And we have disagreements, even internally, all the time, about what we ought to be doing about these sorts of things. A couple of things just to touch on about what this means, and this is just sort of very broad. The first couple of bullets there are about the numbers, the big numbers, and everybody likes to focus on these. I wish we wouldn't spend so much time looking at the aggregate big numbers. You've heard a couple of them mentioned already. California had $500 billion by somebody's measure. You add the state and locals together, you were looking at $766 billion all in right now by their own calculations. If you made all these adjustments that we've proposed, you're looking at $2.2 trillion. Big number. Everybody likes big numbers. But California's a big state, a lot of employees. You could spread that out over a lot of people. Not going to be cheap. And the money's going to have to come from somewhere. We've made these promises. And it will, given current rates of revenue growth, crowd out other spending that a local government could do. And that's a worry. Other spending includes spending on debt service. And so we're trying to evaluate what this means for the likelihood that a local government might back off its commitment to make its debt service payments. Second bullet is not that interesting. It just, not surprisingly, since we're reallocating from those multi-employer plans, and the state numbers that you saw earlier included these multi-employer plans, I'm pretty sure. Didn't put the chart together, so I don't know exactly, but local governments are going to have more of the burden. And you hear this about locals being the ones that are most at risk here, more so than the state probably. State, we don't expect to make a lot of changes for the states, nor for any really major sector. We don't think this is going to be unmanageable, but there are going to be some local governments that are more exposed than others, no question. I can skip that. I really wanted to get to this slide. to show you and put California a little bit, these numbers in perspective. And generally, California local governments don't have a whole lot of debt. You've heard some of that already. We're not Greece. The state is not Greece. Local government debt to general fund revenues. And there are lots of different ways you can measure how much debt do you have out there. And so we've done just a very simple comparison here. It's California cities, and we're just looking at cities at the moment. They're just what we happen to have easily available. That we've put together, when we put together that $766 billion number, that was every local government in California. We added them all up. We have the individual. We went through every single city's, every single school district, every single special district's CAFR that we could find, and we have it in this massive database. Added it all up. That's the number. But if you take all that and you look at California cities, debt to revenue is not very high. Debt to full value, that's your local property tax base, is actually very low compared to national standards. And that's even with a constrained assessed value in California compared to a lot of places. And then if you make these adjustments even that we're proposing for this unfunded liability, make all of those adjustments, and you're looking very average in that third line. That's the same measure as the debt to general fund revenues, but adding the adjusted unfunded actuarial liability, and you're looking at 267% of your general fund revenues. Again, you're just normalizing it on revenues. You could use anything as a denominator here in terms of the numbers. So you could also try it on your debt to full value, again, your property tax base in California. And California doesn't look that bad. The problem is you can't really get access to that full value. You can't raise your property tax here. There's a 1% constitutional limit on the property tax. And unless you've had the general obligation voter override, so there are very few exceptions to that 1%. You can't get access to it. And so where is the money going to come from to pay for these general, for these pension promises? They're going to come from the city, and most city employees are paid for from the general fund. And so we've taken a look at, and this is where the risk comes for local governments in California. You notice this adjustment results in double the national average in California. So California local governments do have a substantial problem, and that liability is likely to grow, and it is going to be expensive, and there's going to have to be some determination of how it's paid for. Right now, it's not clear. They can pay for it, but they're just going to not be paying for other things. And that would be the concern. Okay. This is a little wonky as well. You know, GASB 68, it's a code of the Government Accounting Standards Board, and they're proposing to do similar things. But let me just say quickly that their implementation is later than ours. We want to get to this. We want to get to it as fast as possible. It's taken us a long time even to get all this data together. So we're moving ahead with this unless, again, I can't say what we're going to say once we get all the requests for comments back, all the comments back, where we're going to go with this. But I think we're going to move forward one way or the other. We may change some of the features. The other big difference between ours and GASB's approach would be the discount rate. Ours is looking to be lower. Other than that, pretty much the same. Let me just sum up here with a couple of comments that are very general. Again, you know, we're trying to take a purely analytical approach to this and at the same time recognize that this is an inherently political issue. And we're not an advocate for one approach or another, really. You know, the governor's had his proposals to change pensions, and we're agnostic on what a state chooses or what a local government chooses to use to manage its problems and solve this particular challenge. You know, we really just want to know how much risk is there and the chance that this then causes a city or local government to choose not to pay its other debt. And so I'll leave it at that.
That works now? Okay, I was glad to see Stuart use paper, use some notes, because I'm at the age where my job was to explain the governor's 12-point program, and I'm at the point where I couldn't remember the 12 points, no less what I want to say. what I want to say about them without a little cheat sheets, but I'll sit here and cheat. Number one was equal share of normal costs, that from now on employees and employers must pay 50% of the normal costs. We think that's a big deal. We think it's a very important step forward for a couple of reasons. First, maybe because it's the only way to inject money into the system now. I think we've already had a lot of discussion. I shouldn't labor the point, I suppose. The court seemed to have found, as best as we can figure, that pension rights are vested. They're not only vested for the time that you've worked 10 years, you've had that deferred compensation and you've earned it, but you have a second right from the day you're hired, a contractual right, as long as you continue working, to continue to earn that pension right. And, you know, there may be challenges on that in the future. People may be arguing about it, but right now, for what's deliverable, that's not one of them. We recognize we still may well have a lawsuit over the 50-50. Some people claim we're violating some vested right there. I find that hard to believe. I've been working on and off with the state since 1972, and there have been a lot of changes in the contribution rate over that year. Some have been negotiated, some haven't been negotiated, some employees aren't in unions. So how we were able to do it in the past, I'm told, well, they didn't sue you then, but we might do it now. Well, we'll see. Second point we had, we got point number one, equal share. Point number two was the hybrid. Hybrid was an important point, maybe the most important one that we didn't get. We did the hybrid plan as it was designed or semi-designed was an employee should retire at 75% of final pay. A career employee who did 30 years in the system should get 75% of the final pay. 25% should come from the current defined benefit plan. 25% should come from a defined contribution plan, and 25% from Social Security. I think about half of the government, I believe it's about half, teachers, firefighters, safety are not in Social Security. I think about half of our public employees are in, about half are in, it's fairly close to that anyway. For people not in Social Security, we were going to do 50% of defined benefit plan. This is complicated. It's difficult to design it. You don't know exactly what Social Security is going to be as a percent. And, of course, in the defined contribution plan, you're guessing as to what that's going to produce. As difficult with the so we wanted to leave the mechanics to the Department of Finance to figure out. Well, that was politically a non-starter. We weren't getting there. It wasn't going to happen, so we didn't get the hybrid plan. what did I skip here? One, two, hybrid, three. What we did do instead, something of an alternative was to put in a cap. One of the problems with pensions is people, taxpayers, are quite concerned about it, and they get annoyed, and appropriately so. And one of the most annoying things was these excessive pensions that go into $150,000, $200,000, whatever. So we put a cap on pensionable income of $110,000. So your formula, 2% at 62, 3% at whatever it is, the pensionable income that it applies to cannot exceed $110,000. For the people who don't have Social Security, and 20% more for those who do. The $110,000 wasn't exactly pulled out of a hat. It seemed reasonable with the amount of money that we now all contribute to on Social Security, and that's where we came up with that. We increased the retirement ages. That point we did do. We didn't get it to our plan called for it to be identical to Social Security. We didn't do that. But we did change normal retirement age for most employees, miscellaneous employees, to age 62, to safety to age 57. Now, let me point out that, as I say, I've been dealing with state government on one side of the table or another since 1972. Ronald Reagan was president. He wasn't president yet. On his way. It was governor of California. and the ages at that time were for normal retirement were 55 and 60. So people will now have to work 2 years longer than they did back in the Reagan administration here. Of course, people are living longer, too, so we think that's appropriate and fair, but also a step in a different direction that's ever been taken before since my time in California, anyway. 3-year final pay. One of the agreements, I believe it was in the Duke Majan administration, when one of the other problems and it's happened to a lot of administrations, not just one party, where they borrowed money out of the pension fund. One of the deals for borrowing money in return gave the unions was instead of 3-year final pay, move down to 1-year final pay. Well, that creates opportunities for mischief. If your pension's built on your final year, it creates opportunities to build up that final year one way or another and create an improper pension. So we got 3-year final pay. And another along the same lines was we got regular recurring pay. Your pension is supposed to be built on your paycheck, not on bonuses, not on vacation time left over for the last 5 years, furlough time, car allowances, or other things. Pension is a portion of your pay. Going forward is a portion of your normal recurring pay. Limit post-time and post-employment and post-employment post-retirement employment, I got it. We had these stories of people going out, leaving work on Friday and coming back to work Monday with same pay, only now they're retirement also. We tried to put an end to that without putting an end to the recognition that retirees do contribute, so we still have retirees can come back half-time. And if they're civil service, they can work part of the year, still earn part of the year and get their pension, but they can't earn full salary and pension at the same time. Felons forfeit pensions, that seems pretty obvious, but I have to tell you, on each and every one of these 12 points, there was arguments, there was fighting, there was disagreement. Sure, he's a felon, but what about his poor wife and children? You have to take care of them. There was no point that was easy in this whole process. You know, I want to go back because I realized I forgot a point I wanted to make on 50-50 pay. One of the reasons we think it's important, it's in conjunction with the next thing, which was no pension holidays. One of the reasons we think it's important is going forward, the parties know that there's no free lunch, that if there are pushes for improved benefits, of fixing, improving the benefits, the parties, if you say no pension holidays, the employees have to pay 50, the employer has to pay 50, we think that'll change behavior. People who worked for the University of California for some time might remember how the absence of that changed things a lot. I was working here in the 80s when they said, hey, folks, you don't have to pay anymore, and we're not going to pay anymore either, and that didn't work out so well. No retroactive pensions. If we have time, we won't have time, I don't think, but I'd like to spend a lot of time on SB 400, which was a huge pension increase that was passed in 1999, and one of the worst aspects of it was, of course, it raised things retroactively for everybody on the job. So you've been working for 10, 15, 20 years and earning at a 2% at 60 formula, and suddenly they made it a 2% at 55 formula. What was that, 25% increase in benefits? Nobody had to pay a penny in for any of those benefits. And the PERS board said, our returns are so wonderful, don't worry about it, fellas. And that didn't work out so well either. I said no pension holidays. That was actually the next. Purchase of pension credit for up to 5 years. That's another. Under current law, you're allowed to buy 5 extra years of pension. You're supposed to pay for it yourself. There are two problems with that. One is the charge for paying for yourself seemed awfully low to us. And in fact, when we raised that issue, it's been CalPERS has now raised the amount that people are charged. And the second thing is, Well, you're buying a pension that's based on a 7.5, 7.75 return. Well, 2 minutes. Okay. 7.5, 7.75 return. I think a lot of us would buy a lot of pension if we can be guaranteed that return on it. So I think it's important to get rid of that. And the last two, one had to do with retiree health, and the other had to do with the CalPERS board. But we didn't drop either. It's still the governor is still looking ahead. We certainly intend to come back to those two. We think this is the biggest pension reform anybody can remember. It's a huge amount of money. CalPERS is saying they think $55 billion for their plan. There may be half of the state of California. I think it's clear $100 billion or so is a lot of money, and it may not be enough. Nobody really knows. I mean, the points that we've seen bigger numbers, and we don't know that it's enough. But we think it's a good start in the direction that we need to go, and an important step forward. Right now, you know, somebody retiring at age 50 at 90%, you know, if someone retires at age 50 at 90% pay, and now we change that to age 57 at 10% less, it's not hard to add up close to $1 million for that one change, for that one employee. So this is a significant saving, and it's a step forward, and it should help California's economy. And I can only say I cannot appear anywhere in front of any group without saying the governor is now moving on to the November, and the fact that we want to have, if Proposition 30 doesn't pass, these forums may be passe, because if we're going to affect our budget, we're going to do it at the ballot in November.
It's great to be here, and I will start off with a slight amendment. After I wrote this title, I thought maybe that's a little too blunt. I mean, especially after Marty. My apologies to you and the governors and the folks who frankly worked very hard on this. And you made comments. You said someone said this is the most you can get through the legislature. I think it was Stu. I agree with that. My message is it's not enough. So I'm going to change this title slightly. Instead of AB 340 doesn't solve the problem, I'm going to change it to AB 340 doesn't come remotely close to solving the problem. and that's part of my message today, unfortunately. I just don't think it does enough. I think we have a long way to go. I'm heartened to hear that the governor's going to continue pushing, because I think he has to. So you heard from Eric about some of these assumptions and methods and so forth, and they clearly drive a lot of the problem. And I thought it'd be useful to contrast and compare what happens in the public sector pensions versus the private sector. And these are private sector DBs as well, so defined benefits. So it's an apples-to-apples comparison in terms of the benefits. CalPERS, as you know, now uses a 7.5% discount rate. That's the same as the investment rate of return. Those are wed together in that system. That is not the case in the private sector. They discount their liabilities at about roughly 4 to 4.5%. I have 4 to 5 here. I think it's a little less than that. The investment rate of return can be all over the map, but the contributions that they make aren't based on the investment rate of return. They're based on the discount rate. So very different determination. Amortization period is 30 years for CalPERS. So you know, if you're hugely underfunded, you have 30 years to pay it off. That's an awfully long time, given that the average duration of liabilities weighted is about 16 years. In the private sector, it's 7 years. Asset smoothing, 15 years in the public sector, 2 years in the private sector. The net result of all these rules and methods and assumptions are that they push cost way in the future. This is the super wimpy plan. Remember Wimpy from Popeye? I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. I will gladly fund your pension in 20 years or 10 years, but I'll guarantee it today. And that system doesn't work very well. I wanted to show you a couple of examples of how the impact of some of those assumptions and methods and so forth. I presented something to the Fullerton City Council the other day, and this simply shows the change in the contribution rates required by the city if you change the investment rate of return assumption. So the red one at the bottom, and you can all see safety, so I'll focus on safety. At the very the first or the lowest bar there for safety is under the current, or what was current at the time. This was done in 2010, so 7.75% rate of return. Their safety contribution rate for the city alone was a little over 30%. If you change that to 7.5%, it bumps up to about 35. If you assume 6%, it bumps up to 60%. So you go from 30 to 60% by moving to what I think is a more realistic rate of return. I mean, that's going to cause real pain at the local level. Solutions to this, I think, start with recognizing the magnitude of the problem. I think Governor Brown, from early on, even before he was elected, made it clear he understands the magnitude of the problem. And I feel it's necessary to say every time I speak that you can't invest your way out of this, not even if you're Bernie Madoff. And the reason I say that is because I had a conversation not that long ago with someone, I'll just say a high-ranking person with one of the major public pension funds here in California, who said, we can invest our way out. And I said, well, let's run some Monte Carlo simulations, these financial simulations, and let's see what you need to invest your way out. Well, you need to earn 14% every year for the next 15 to 20 years to have an 85% chance of investing your way out. The numbers are huge. You know, not even Bernie Madoff can do that, right? And I hear that those weren't real. So that's a problem. So what are the solutions? You have to reduce benefits. You have to have greater cost sharing, as is contained in AB 340. You have to have new revenues, I think, in the long run. The question is, I think, for a lot of people, what the order is of those solutions. Cities had already begun to reduce benefits over the last few years. I remember I live in Larkspur, and I went to Novato to a city council meeting, and they were really excited because they had negotiated an additional 1% contribution from their employees. And I said, it doesn't matter. So everyone's been moving very, very slowly, but at least in the right direction here. So some folks have moved from a 36 to a 12-month final salary determination. Again, a good part of AB 340 fixes that. But let's say you've been doing that. It's going to take a long time because, on average, the attrition rate for the system is about 3%. So in 30 years, you'll be okay. 30 years is not soon enough. Second tiers reduce costs slightly. A couple of examples, if you can see them. First one, if you move from 3 at 50, this is a safety plan, to 3 at 55, that reduces your contribution rate about 4%. So if you're the case of Fullerton, they go from 30% to 26%. Moves you in the right direction, but really doesn't get you there. Same sort of thing for miscellaneous. If you go from 2.5 at 55 to 2 at 60, reduces it about 2%. One of the problems is, and this goes back to that second slide about the accounting methods and so forth, the unfunded amortization rate increases that are baked in to CalPERS rate setting will eliminate those benefits, those savings, in about 2.5 years. So even if you can immediately move to those lower tiers and you can move everyone to those lower tiers, your costs are still going to be higher if you're a city, a county, a special district a couple of years from now, and they will continue to go higher. Increased cost sharing will only reduce expenditures, but only slightly. A 50-50 share of all cost, which frankly I wish had been in the bill. I know there are problems with that, but I think that's a better solution. And this 30% number is based on my analysis of about 20 different cities and counties across California, fairly well represented. So if you could get employees and employers to share half and half, 50-50, you'd be able to reduce your employer contributions about 30%. So that's another good start. That's a pretty good number. Unfortunately, because it only includes normal cost, the savings will actually be about 10%. Part of the reason for that is because AB 340 also has caps for those employee contributions. So you can only contribute up to 12% for safety and 8% for miscellaneous. And so there are cities that are saying, gee, this is great, but then they do the math and they figure out that it doesn't really move the needle that much for them. So AB 340 is only a start. 30-year state and local agency retirement spending. Retirement includes OPEBs, retiree health care. And frankly, you ought to include retiree health care because those are obligations that we've made. And if we're going to be honest about the math, they ought to be on the table. So if you total up CalPERS, CalSTRS, UC, locals, et cetera, that those retirement costs are going to be at least $600 billion over the next 30 years if things go absolutely exceedingly well. Sorry? That's CalPERS numbers. That's CalPERS, STRS, and OPEB numbers essentially projected out. The CalPERS, I can give the details later, but it's the CalPERS number that was published about 2 years ago. So about $600 billion, it will likely be closer, in my opinion, to $1 trillion. So somewhere between six and a trillion, if I had to, you know, pick that 50th percentile, I'd probably say about $900 billion, roughly. Savings estimated are about $78 billion, so $55 from PERS, $23 from STRS. Others are unclear. There'll be some savings there. They won't be huge, I don't think. So the bottom line is that AB 340 addresses about 10% of the problem. So you got 90% of the problem still left on the table. As Marty was talking, I thought, you know, this isn't the most glaring omission from AB 340. The most glaring omission, I think, is, I didn't put it up here because I didn't expect it to be in the final bill, and that's the hybrid. I mean, if the governor had gotten the hybrid as he wanted, that would have made a big difference, I think, certainly. But in my mind, I never thought the legislature would go there, so I sort of took that off the table in my mind. But I think one of the most glaring omissions is the lack of governance reform. It's not the fact that, it's not the math. I mean, the math isn't that hard. What's hard is the politics, is the governance. And so, and those are really important because boards set those assumptions, they set the discount rates, they set all these different things that drive decisions that either fund the pension systems well or fail to fund them well, as we've seen here in California. One of the things, I believe there are a lot of inherent conflicts for people who sit on the board, PERS, STRS, and so forth. Another thing that I've pointed to a couple of times, this is in, some people have heard me say this before, I think it's a real problem that there are no technical or other qualifications required for PERS or STRS board members. You don't have to have a relevant degree. And I see Mayor Reed is here, and he's going to be on the next panel. I would urge the governor and others to look to San Jose to see what they've done. They have completely restructured their governance their governance structure. They actually have folks on the board who are required to have 12 years of relevant experience and a relevant degree. And so I think they're clearly heading in the right direction there. And I think we could use them as a model. That's my contact information. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
So good afternoon. Let me begin by just very briefly indicating the point of view I bring to this issue. When I was asked to be a member of the panel, I was told they wanted someone to speak from labor's perspective. And in fact, I'm a very strong supporter of organized labor and public employee unions in particular. However, I'm not a formal representative of any union. So if you want to hear from an elected representative of California's unions, you have to talk to one of those people. And I think there's one of them on a subsequent panel. But if not, you'll have to find one. Secondly, I'm a long-term resident of San Jose, so my view cannot help but be shaped by living in a city whose leaders have disastrously politicized the pension issue. So from my perspective, how should we approach this problem that we're talking about in the panel? Well, I think we should begin by remembering the statement of the great 20th century American philosopher, Yogi Berra. And Yogi Berra said, everybody know who Yogi Berra was? And Yogi Berra said, if you don't know where you're going, any road will do. So my approach is to try and look at the goals of pension changes and evaluate strategies in relationship to those goals rather than simply throw strategies at the wall. Okay, so what are some of the goals that I would consider important? First, support collective bargaining as a mechanism to determine wages and benefits of which pensions are a part. I say that not simply because of a philosophical preference for the importance of collective bargaining for the dignity and rights of working people, but also because I think it is, in fact, an effective way to reach these decisions. If you look at California, pension changes have been negotiated successfully all over the place. A League of Cities survey found 47% of cities had bargained lower pensions for new hires, and 64% had bargained increased employee pension contributions in their jurisdiction. As one of the previous speakers, I forgot his name, he's the Roach Motel guy, as he mentioned, the employer had, there you go.
There he is.
The employer has substantial advantages in these negotiations, and clearly, even when there are constitutional limits, has the capacity to induce concessions. I have seen unions in San Jose put proposals on the table that would reduce pensions for current employees without waiving constitutional rights. And frankly, in that city, the reason negotiated settlements were not achieved was because the city made the political decision not to have a settlement, no matter what concessions were put on the table. Also, negotiated agreements reduce political conflict, avoid litigation, and tend to maintain rather than tear apart the social fabric of communities. Finally, using negotiations helps illustrate the very significant differences between pension debt and bonded debt. Outside of bankruptcy, it's hard to negotiate down your bonded obligations. Through negotiations, governments can negotiate lower salaries, which reduce pension costs, negotiate higher pension contributions from their employees, which obviously reduces their costs, negotiate changes in promotion patterns that reduces pension costs, and of course they have the ability to reduce staffing, which they don't even need to negotiate on, which reduces pension costs. The second goal, protect people's constitutional rights. I strongly oppose trying to deny certain people constitutional guarantees that they've had their entire working life because they happen to be currently unpopular and elected officials think they can get away with doing that. My reason for that is a knowledge of history. I think it is a kind of behavior that becomes habit-forming among political elites. Therefore, I don't support either trying to devise new legal doctrines or changing the Constitution to deny people's longstanding rights. Third goal, protecting local government services, which I believe to be critical to people's lives. I spent 20 years in local government in Santa Clara County. Now, this point is very relevant to one of the issues that we're discussing on this panel, which is what should be the rate of return for pension plans. Obviously, if you dramatically reduce the rate of return, you dramatically increase the costs to local governments, you dramatically increase crowd out, you dramatically increase pressure on the other services that the government provides. Now, for some people who advocate these significant lower rates of return, that's a good thing. Their political goal is to induce panic and attack unions. But many people don't have that as an objective. They are arguing for lower rates of return because they have a philosophical perspective that I would simply describe as don't kick the can down the road. That is, don't encumber subsequent generations with costs associated with mistakes made by our generation. I think there is another philosophical perspective that's worth comparing to that one, and that is the perspective that is, don't make the perfect storm worse, which is, if you find yourself in a situation where you have the worst recession in 50 years, a slow recovery, low tax revenues, high unemployment, a shattered safety net, then one of the things you would try and do is not precipitate an additional crisis. And if you do manage to shift some costs into the future, what history suggests is, since this is the worst recession in 50 years, the people in the future will probably be in better shape to withstand those costs than people are today. Another related question is, if you're going to try and make decisions about what these rates of return should be, who should make the decision? I tend to prefer the decisions to be made by the people who are actually managing pension plans and on the basis of history. Now, it's true that people who manage pension plans are fallible, and history is not a reliable guide, right, as every prospectus will tell you. But what are the alternatives? If you don't rely on the directors of the plans, who do you rely on? Moody's? If you're going to rely on Moody's, you should look at the report of the United States Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations on the Wall Street and Financial Crisis. Pay particular attention to Section 5, titled Inflated Credit Ratings, Case Study of Moody's and Standard & Poor's. Elected officials? I suggest you read the State Auditor's report on the City of San Jose's pension cost projections, which will tell you that the city's projections were literally fabricated out of whole cloth and used deliberately to create an atmosphere of crisis. And if you don't rely on history, what do you rely on? Theory? Economic theory? Social theory? The batting average for those perspectives isn't that high. I can remember Alan Greenspan telling the Congress in a very subdued manner how shocked he was that financial institutions did not, in fact, act the way they were predicted to at the University of Chicago. Finally, I would point out that just from a personal, philosophical, and moral perspective, I don't really have a great problem with intergenerational transfers. One of my cousins served under General Patton and died fighting the Nazis, so I wouldn't have to. My father never paid a dime into Medicare and enjoyed that program until he died. I've paid into it my whole life. None of those things bother me. I think that's what being part of a country is all about. Next goal, avoid unforeseen negative consequences. And since unforeseen consequences happen all the time in public policy, you would think that there would be serious attention to these possibilities in pension reform. But of course, they don't happen at all. My friend from the Little Hoover mentioned, is it safe to have pension funds only funded at 78 or 80% of their full obligations, which is a very fair question and should be asked. What I would ask is it safe to have a 67-year-old bus driver on the street? And that question is never asked. I'm 66. I work out regularly. I don't have the reflexes I had when I was 55. Another unforeseen consequences. We have workers staying on the job longer. What about opportunities for a younger generation that is struggling desperately to find its way forward in the job market? What are the implications of some of these reforms on low-wage public workers and low-income retirees? How do we fill public sector jobs in the future? Now, this problem is compounded in places like San Jose, where pension and compensation cuts were combined with political scapegoating. And that's not always the case. And in fact, to give credit where credit is due, Joe Nation's report on pension costs in San Jose included a footnote that said, before you decide how much you're going to ask your employees to pay in increased contributions, do a compensation survey and see what's going to happen. Your footnote, however, was completely ignored by the leadership of San Jose, and now we have the spectacle in San Jose of having crime rates reaching very, very high levels, police officers, including the chief, abandoning the city, and even other technical jobs being virtually impossible to fill. The city of San Jose just signed a contract with a temporary employment agency to spend $270,000 a year for an electrician at its sewage treatment plant, assuming no holiday pay and no overtime at a facility that operates 24/7. And that is what the taxpayers of San Jose can expect from a perspective that doesn't even try and look at unforeseen consequences. And my last point, I have a goal of providing earned retirement security for working families, which means if someone spends a lifetime at work, they should be able to spend the remainder of their time on earth without working and enjoying a decent standard of living. Defined benefit plans, with all their warts, are very good at accomplishing that. They have significant structural advantages in doing that. The record for the alternative defined contribution plans is unmitigated disaster. It's hard to think of any public policy that works worse than defined contribution plans as a mechanism of achieving earned retirement security, except perhaps the idea of building prisons to deal with the drug problem. Public employee pensions are the last bastion of defined benefit plans, and I worry if they disappear, if they're replaced with something else, the defined benefit plan will essentially disappear from history, and that means for the vast majority of Californians, the goal of earned retirement security will become absolutely impossible. Thank you for listening.
So we're going to open it up for questions. Just to go over the ground rules, please state your name when you're called on, and also minimize commentary and ask in the form of a question. Thanks. Over here.
My name is Shelby Song. I work for UC Berkeley. This is a question for Mr. Nation. Mr. Nation, you advocated for a more, quote-unquote, more professional board, a board with more professional experience. But if you recall, during 2007-08, with all the One Street geniuses with all the fancy degrees, you know, they didn't do much good to the economy of this country. So, what professional experience were you?
Well, I'll just point to some existing research out there today that shows that the higher the skill levels, the associated skill levels. I mean, people who have economics degrees or accounting degrees or law degrees, or that the higher percentage on a board, the better the board performs, the better the outcomes. And I just think it's nuts to have a board that manages a $240 billion fund not have anyone who is required to have any expertise in a relevant field. I think that's crazy.
Yeah, I'd like to say something about that. I'm interested in people on the board having the expertise, but I'm more interested in the board being disinterested. The CalPERS board has six elected, out of 13 people, six of them are elected by the unions. One of them is actually serves at the pleasure of the governor. There are other elected officials, people held over from past. When I was on the board when SB 400 passed, there were eight union representatives on a 13-member board. They didn't use good judgment. They distributed to us as board members material, which I later, in July of 1999, published as a memo to managers to try and tamp down the desire for SB 400, pointing out that the costs could go up from $150 million a year to $4 billion a year on the state if the investments didn't go so well in the future. The board, at the same time, not one person voted against the measure, and they put out a pamphlet assuring that these costs would be absorbed by the investment return. I think that was bad judgment that because of their affiliation, maybe they had almost no choice. And it would have been much better to have a board that was disinterested, whatever their level of expertise. Though the governor's proposal does ask for two people with expertise.
Could I just add to that? I'm sorry. The other leg of the SB 400 story was it didn't stop at the state level. It encouraged cities and counties around the state to say, yes, we want that as well. And at the county and city level, you've got neighboring entities that could bid away your firefighters, your battalion chiefs, your cops. And so it was very difficult for local government to do that. One of the things when they came to the commission is, please give us a backstop to save us from ourselves because of that. Sorry, thanks.
In the back here.
My name is John Polland. Professor Nation, I think you stated that this is a problem that we cannot invest our way out of. In light of that comment and perhaps the experiences of cities like Oakland and Stockton, do you believe that pension obligation bonds are a prudent way for cities to, or even the state, to attempt to solve this problem?
If you feel really lucky,
It's probably not a bad way to go. But general, I mean, there may be some cases. I mean, if you have a side fund, for example, if you're a local government that has a side fund and CalPERS is implicitly charging you 7.5% and you can pay it off at less than that, that makes sense. But otherwise, it's kind of a tougher sell. And I think you've got to really feel lucky, and you've got to be lucky. And in the case of Oakland, they haven't been very lucky with their pension obligation bonds.
In the back here.
Judy Lynn with the Associated Press. This question is for Marty. I guess I'm wondering, when do you see another opportunity to continue to negotiate the pension board change and healthcare, retiree healthcare part, you know, when you're already moving on to Prop 30, you've got lots of things ahead of you. You know, was this an opening politically, and were you able to seize the most that you could get?
You're right. Proposition 30 is the first and foremost thing on the agenda right now. Health, I think, will come in part of a greater approach to the whole health problem, perhaps. We had on there only 2 points, but I think the whole question of retiree health and maybe public health in this state has to be addressed. The board requires a board change requires a constitutional change, as does a lot of other things that people are talking about, and just when and how people are going to be prepared to go to the voters, to be honest with you, it's very hard to answer at this time.
Dan Bornstein. Marty, a couple questions. First of all, did you consider putting in some sort of control on vested rights for new employees?
Excuse me?
Did you consider putting in some sort of control on vested rights for new employees? It
no.
seems like that would have been a no-brainer.
Yeah. It was only discussed peripherally, and it really wasn't. You know, these were very difficult times to get through this. The original SB 400 back in 99 went through the state Senate. It went through two committees of the state Senate and the floor of the state Senate without one single no vote. I bring that up to say that the accomplishment of what we did this time to get these changes in the other direction was not a small accomplishment. It was difficult. There one person who raised that issue that you're just mentioning, at least in my presence, was Governor Brown. But it was not something we thought we could get into the final legislation.
And then the second question is, are you guys perhaps overselling this a little bit as to what you accomplished? And
I'm thing sorry.
I think, are you perhaps overselling what you accomplished? And what I'm thinking of especially is the 50-50 split on the normal cost. As Joe pointed out, there's a cap on it. And moreover, it really doesn't apply to local government. It only gives them the ability to impose if there's a political will, which we've certainly seen there hasn't been at the local level in 2018. So aren't you kind of overselling that portion of it?
Are we overselling it? No, we're not. We're selling it just right because it's a very big advance. We didn't put a cap on it. We raised the cap that was already there. The caps were already there from PERS. We raised them by a percent or two in each case. And we just didn't feel like it felt it's kind of hard enough to run the state of California without completely taking over charge of running all the cities and counties also. So we did the best we could, and I think it was a pretty good job.
Way in the back, and then over here.
Yeah, my name is Chris Peoples. I find it interesting that when it came to protecting Goldman Sachs bonuses, the federal government came up with between $3 and $7 trillion. TARP was pretty trivial. The Fed came up with most of it. Yet when it comes to protecting pensions and public employees and UAW employees and working class people, all of a sudden we have no money.
And this will be our last question, so I encourage you to continue the conversation afterward. But.
Oh, thank you. David Crane, I have a question for Eric. I'm hoping you can explain this to me. Before Stockton declared bankruptcy, as I understand it, the size of its pension liability, as calculated by CalPERS, was calculated using a 7.5% discount rate. Mm-hmm. But after bankruptcy, as part of CalPERS's claim, my understanding is they're using a 3.8% discount right now for the size of its claim in bankruptcy. Can you explain that?
I'm afraid I can't explain that. No.
It's BA. Talk to me.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, we have to draw this to a close because we have another panel, and I believe we have 15 minutes break. Sorry, 10 minutes break, and we'll see you back in 10 minutes. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.